Hey, it's Keith Tomasek, and you're listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. On today's show, Rick Miller. You might know Rick as the man behind the hilarious one-man show, MacHomer. MacHomer was also the first show to go from the Fringe Festival here in Canada to the Stratford Festival. But Rick has done so much more than that. He's an accomplished writer, actor, producer, performer, and we talk about all of that in the episode today. Rick's worked with some of the most successful international artists like Peter Gabriel and Robert Lepage. And right now, Rick's one-man show, Boom, is on stage. So stick around. We're going to talk about that. Of course, as I always do, I have to say thank you so much to my sponsor, Stratford Tea Leaves. You can check out stratfordtealeaves.com. Karen Hartwick is Canada's tea sommelier. She runs stratfordtealeaves.com, and she travels all around the world to bring the freshest and most exotic loose leaf teas to her customers, like me, and maybe you. So if you like tea as much as I do, check out stratfordtealeaves.com. All right, Rick Miller, what a man. What a powerful, powerful force to be reckoned with. I don't know. Sat down with him at a little cafe near his home in Toronto, and just learned so much about his creative process, and he's going to share that with you. I did want to let you know before I do that, though, we've got some great episodes coming up. If you're new to The Inadequate Life, go back to the episode guide. Just visit theinadequatelife.com for all the back episodes, theinadequatelife.com. Or you can get them on iTunes or on your iPhone. The iPhone has a new podcast app. That should be there. Just search for The Inadequate Life, and you'll find a lot of the back episodes. Coming up in the next couple of weeks, Al Ray from CBC Radio, and he's the curator and artistic director of the Winnipeg Comedy Festival. Someone else from the world of comedy, Martha Chavez, is going to be on the show. She's an emerging playwright, but a very successful comedian who, at the age of 17, arrived in Canada to escape the political persecution of Nicaragua. And I was in Montreal when she arrived, and we got to know each other back then. So that's a really cool blast from the past for me. But today it's Rick Miller, and I'm so excited because when we talk about creativity, and you know, part of the podcast is about the creative process and helping you get through whatever it is you're working on, because I know you're a creative soul and I'm a creative soul, and we sure hit roadblocks. But I tell you, meeting Rick was inspiring on so many levels. And Rick doesn't, we talked about playwriting in terms of Boom and his new show. And Rick told me he doesn't think of himself as a playwright, but rather as someone who puts together experiences in a room, which I really loved. He'll elaborate on that in the podcast. And talking about failure, because not all of these experiences have been a success, as you know, that's the deal. If you're a creative person, good luck making them all winners. And they're not going to be. So how do you deal with failure? Well, Rick says failure for him is just a step to improvement. And that's really, really how you have to think about those stumbling blocks along the way. You can't let them bring you down. You got to pick yourself up and just keep on moving. And finally, one of the things Rick talked about that was really cool was the transition. You know, he's written and directed and acted in so many of his own works and often collaborated with others as a writer-director. But he was recently in a show called Venus and Fur that Pat Donnelly at the Montreal Gazette called the best piece of theater, English or French, in Montreal in the year 2014. It started at Canadian Stage in Toronto. He said his transition from being a writer, director, and actor of his own work to having to audition for Jennifer Tarver, the director, in Venus and Fur was quite an experience. And he talks about that. We recorded the podcast in the spring, so there are some time references that might mess you up. And at the time, he was still teaching in his class at U of T. That comes up a little bit. So thanks for sticking around. Don't forget to visit theinadequatelife.com or check us out on iTunes. And here comes the interview with Rick Miller. So here we are. This is a little patisserie just near your, at ton coin.
That's right. So mon coin, c'est Patisserie La Cigogne, which is a place that's set up. Many other restaurants have tried and failed here, but somehow this tapped into a lot of the creative people actually in the neighborhood come and do some work here. They, I sit and I do a lot of video editing. It's
wow,
seems a strange
video
thing.
On yeah. a laptop in here.
Yeah, and headphones. And I personally like, there's certain kind of creative work where I find isolation works best, and others where I need to not necessarily be engaged with, I don't want people disturbing my work, but I want to see the flow of people.
Yeah.
And I find writing, for instance, the kind of writing I do, which is usually pretty connective, mm-hmm. suits itself pretty well to a cafe.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I get that. I grew up in Montreal, and now I live in suburbia, and I miss that, the flow of people. That's a good way of describing it, to know you're always surrounded by the human condition and whatever that might be.
Yeah, in this new show I wrote called Boom, it was very much based on, well, it wouldn't have been created without the internet and the Wikipedia, YouTube sort of world, where I'm drawing references and creating a kind of tableau of the baby boom with a bunch of different pieces. So I felt that sort of superficial level of connectivity you find where you're slightly distracted suited this particular play. Okay. Whereas other plays and other certain creative endeavors demand complete attention, sure, and you get annoyed at your kids for bugging funny. You. And the other ones where you can allow, again, this flow of ideas.
We'll talk about the kids thing. But let's go way back to Montreal. Are you from Montreal originally?
I am from Montreal.
Now, you got a master's in architecture from McGill University, and I've read you've got half a theater degree. So the question is, how does a guy with that background end up collaborating with legends like Robert Lepage and Peter Gabriel and creating your own works that get people into theaters and thinking about important issues all around the world? How did that happen?
Well, I guess it starts with a mix of two of the profound ingredients that I find all the people I admire have, which is a mixture of arrogance and humility.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And
you know that about yourself.
I know it about myself.
When did you figure that out?
Early on, I realized I was someone who was pretty skilled at a lot of different things, but not particularly great at one thing, which I then later found out was a trait of most architects. They can talk about everything somewhat eloquently, but they're not particularly good at anything. They get specialists, engineers to build the buildings. They're good at tying things together. And that was always my skill. And the kind of work that attracted me was work by people like Robert Lepage, interdisciplinary stuff, yep, where you're not necessarily doing the most heavily text-based, solid, sure, Shakespeare, but you're doing things to Shakespeare that no one has ever done before. Right. Peter Gabriel is also a big dreamer. And I've met these people. They are arrogant only in their ambition sometimes to say,
we can,
you know what,
it.
I want to, in the case of Gabriel, big social justice imperatives of, you know, I want to create a whole, use technology to better empower witnesses of atrocities in Africa, to Lepage saying, I want to make a 9-hour play, getting a bunch of...
Which seems very arrogant.
It does seem arrogant to some people. And yet, when you know the guy and you realize that deep down, he's just someone who's very good at drawing connections and weaving together various talents, cultures, languages. Yeah. Sometimes what in one would perceive as a superficial way, but only superficial in the sense that as these things take many years to evolve, it gets deeper and deeper.
Right, yeah.
And if you use a cooking analogy, it starts and you got a lot of lumps in your pot. But as you get in there, you get to these fabulous concoctions that one could not dream of if you didn't have that ambition.
And when did you in your psyche start having those dreams? What was the house like? Because I understand what you're saying in terms of the theatrical experience growing up in Montreal. It's much different than it is in the rest of Canada because you have the French culture and you have the joie de vivre. There's all kinds of, it's a multicultural environment. So I got exposed to things that I never would have seen had I grown up in Alberta or something like that. So when you were little, what did you see, little sparks of theater, or did your parents, what were your parents doing?
Unfortunately, even though my dad came from Europe and brought, he had a lot of, I guess, European culture in his background. Yeah. I was the youngest of four boys. So I think the highest level of culture I had was Meatloaf in 1976.
The rock musician.
Yeah, you know, and that still remained with me. I still love rock and roll.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he put on a show.
I know, and Meatloaf, I sing in a band as well, and we just played our first Meatloaf song the other day.
What did your folks do?
Well, they didn't throw much culture at us at all. It was all about sports. So I had to find it myself. Even the more sophisticated levels of music, the Tom Waitses of the world, for instance, those kind of things, and Peter Gabriel only came to me later when I got into college and studied architecture. And I met quote unquote artsy people who exposed me to Ani DiFranco. But back then,
so
it was all about journey.
How did that feel? So you were the journey, the Meatloaf guy, the sports guy, and you're tall, good looking, nice physique. And then how did you even fit into those artsy guys? You know, did you start wearing black clothes all the time?
I grew my hair like everyone did at a certain point. But no, I could always dabble and fit in with many different groups.
Crowds, okay.
And that's how I still feel in the arts. I'm involved in a lot of different disciplines, and I can converse and make great friends, but I'm still a bit always on the outside.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's conscious or unconscious, but it's a happy place for me to be able to, if something bores me or irritates me or is not going particularly well, I can just remove that hat for the moment, slip on another hat and focus on something else in a career where, as you know, in the inadequate life, we're always hustling.
Yeah, it is. I hate to say that, but it is a hustle. Yeah. You're only as good as your last piece of work. And you know.
Exactly. And you don't exist in a vacuum. You create in a collaborative environment where you need audiences, and you need reviewers.
Where did you get the ability to, because a lot of people can't handle that hustle and they don't have that. They have no drive to, you're a guy who makes things. You're a can-do kind of guy. Where did that come from?
I think my father was blessed with part of this arrogance that it was partly what irritated my mother, but he had this confidence to him, this self-confidence. Yeah. And it's something you can't really tell someone to be. And I was blessed with a lot of confidence where failure to me was not something that was heavy-handed. It was not an end game. Failure was just a step towards just continuing to improve.
So do you ever get down? It sounds like you're always up.
No, I do get down. People think of me as this, the busiest guy in showbiz. No, I take a lot of time to balance my career and my family, and it's difficult sometimes.
I bet,
always
yeah,
difficult.
I bet.
And yet, I look at my life and my work in images often, in this case of a DNA molecule, you've got a double helix.
Yeah.
And the two, life and work, are always weaving together, but they're never touching, and they're always coexisting.
Sure.
So I don't necessarily live or work, and I'm lucky. They coexist.
And at some point, when you make that commitment to have a family and a career, you kind of have to say to yourself, okay, I realize they're going to be able to coexist, and you have to sort of give into that as opposed to trying to fight it or that sort of thing.
That's right. And when you run your own business as well, you can make certain decisions where you realize, okay, I have to sacrifice a bit of the income this year because my marriage is struggling and
demanding,
we got to work through this.
Yeah, or I got to put my kid in, took my kid to swimming lessons. I mean, I was, it's like every week I got to be there at a certain time. I am now committed. So let's, just because you brought up teaching, let's talk a bit about that. You teach a course at the University of Toronto. It's called The Architecture of Creativity, right?
Yes.
So the syllabus, it says you look at the common architecture of theater, music, cinema, fine and visual art, and new media, which is really you. That's when I see the works that you've done on stage. That represents what you are. Tell me a bit about the what kind of kids do you get in that? Everyone must want to sign up, or is it you get to pick them?
It was the first time we did this particular class, and these are students who were all showed an interest in working in different disciplines, but didn't necessarily have the experience of doing so. And so I have them in the one case, one project we just finished, I have them performing something out of their comfort zone.
Right.
So I wanted a music student to paint a painting and
vice versa.
And visual arts student to write a theater monologue, all in an effort, again, to gain this perspective, to say that by being locked in a box in isolation is useful for a certain part of your creative process, but to be able to step back and see that there's a commonality to dance, to anything. Yeah. And I call it this architecture, which, again, I look at it perhaps in, again, an arrogant point of view, but there's something, as a generalist, there's something you can draw parallels between these things.
Sure.
And it's not necessarily the only way to create, but if you are a maker of things,
right,
if you are a creator of things, you can gain from seeing that when you're stuck making your music piece, open a visual arts book.
Go somewhere else, yeah.
Or
yeah,
go to a museum. Yeah, yeah. It will, the solution can often be found somewhere else.
Well, I noticed that. I love that in your syllabus, that part of your syllabus, I mean, I'm teaching too, so I've got a syllabus, the same things you have, do this, do that, do this, read this. But then you've also have attend, go see this exhibition, go to this art gallery, which I had never even thought of that, but that's brilliant. Yeah.
Well, I've been allowed this. Again, it's a luxurious class in that it's a half year class spread out over a full year. So I see them every second Friday, sometimes only every third Friday because I'm off opening
a
new show.
Yeah.
But I think the advantage is when I'm creating a show here, I can bring them into the process, bring them into the room
see
how we work and how, in the case of theater, which is usually how I start creations, because I'm familiar with how to catalyze material in that world, I bring in people of talent who basically do what I do, but that much better.
Yeah. Earlier you talked a bit about being the architect and being the sort of almost like a, I mean, I hate to use the word puppeteer, but you're sort of in charge with a vision and working with people who can help you see your vision.
Dungeon master.
Oh, all right.
No, I'm just kidding. Just remembered I played D&D as a kid and I was the dungeon
Did
master.
You?
Go
yeah.
figure.
So just a little while ago, you were in a play, Venus and Fur, where you were basically an actor. Is that right? You were
Correct.
Just an actor. You know, the reviews, your buddy, Richard Ozunian, he loves you, hates you, right? Sexy, sophisticated, side-splittingly funny. It got great reviews. It's the American playwright David Eves play. He's collaborating with Stephen Sondheim right now. So you're working with amazing work, and it was directed by Jennifer Tarver,
yes,
who worked at Stratford. So was that the first time that you've completely let yourself go to someone else? It almost sounds like you don't often do that.
In a while, it was the first time I had just been an actor for hire.
How hard was that? Going from the guy who's got all these millions of scripts in your head, because you never know when you're going to be going somewhere and doing something. You've got to put that step aside and just become the character.
If I'm going to teach my students to be comfortable out of their comfort zone and to take risks, this was, you know, what a lot of actors do. They go audition for stuff. It was out of my comfort zone to actually go audition, to go through three levels of auditions for 2 months.
When was the last time you did three auditions in a row?
I don't remember auditioning. I sometimes audition for cartoon voices and such, but I because I cast and create my own work, it's a lot easier to audition, to cast yourself.
You get up the nerve to do the first audition.
Yes.
And it must have gone okay.
It went very well. Actually, Carly and I, Jennifer tells this story, Carly and I were the first people, yes, Carly Street, who's remarkable. It's a good play. I could tell right away this was a smart play. It was funny. It was entertaining. And yet it was very, very, it was full of, again, using the word architecture, a very sophisticated journey into a pretty deep psychologically disturbing experience.
Female dominance.
And gender politics and the arrogance of, you know, of males in our society generally. And so it was a place where, yes, it was uncomfortable because I knew I was going to have to, I was going to be led around if I got this part by a woman who happens to be a goddess. And she was basically going to, you know, mess around with my head and get me tied to a post in the end so that she could show me what a misogynist I was. So yes, out of my comfort zone. And I was delighted to go through it.
I thought
it.
You were talking about the director there. You're talking about your girl.
This is just the play itself.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Working with Jennifer was going to be a great thing, but Carly and I were her first audition.
What was the biggest challenge she gave you as an actor working with the director?
Being an asshole, to be honest. I tend to be a pretty nice guy and quite caring about my partner. Yeah. My acting partner, and yet this play is about he's an ass, right? He is, in some ways, he's a playwright and a director like me, which is partly why Jennifer cast me, and partly why I wasn't so much out of my comfort zone in that I'm playing a playwright, director, actor.
Familiar with the territory.
Yes. But she said, even after our first previews, Rick, it's great, but for this play to really sing, the first 15 minutes of the play, you must despise this woman.
Wow.
She's walking into the room. It's an audition scenario.
Sure.
She's walking into the room being everything you hate about women and everything your sort of male superiority, your elite white male superiority. She's playing to that and tapping into it. Hmm. You can't
like her at all.
You can't be nice.
Yeah.
You can't be the kind guy that you are.
That's interesting.
Even though I felt I was already being quite the ass. So
in that
sense, I had to kick it up. And she was right.
So what was the half? We talked at the very beginning about a half a theater degree. What was that?
Well, I was studying architecture very happily so.
At McGill
in Montreal. And I knew even from the first or from second year that I did not want to be
An architect
per se. The profession itself is glorious, but only for a few people that have the liberty to do what they really want in architecture. Most of the time you're building service work and drawing fire stairs for a long time. It's not glamorous. And not that I needed glamour, but I also realized I had a lot more fun in some ways putting together the presentations and performing in the talent shows.
Sure. And had before that, in high school, were you a theater person at all or not?
I went to French high school. And so even though I was creative, I was not a funny guy at all in French. It was only when I got to CEGEP, it was kind of grades 12 and 13, and that I realized that I had a sense of humor and an ability to parody. I had a voice that could play a lot of different characters, and I could sing. And all these things sort of coalesced quite late, first into musicals. I started doing musicals, as many people do. You know, they do Grease and HMS Pinafore by Gilbert and Sullivan. And I remember when I was in second year architecture, I was sitting in the room when one of our teachers brought in this guy named Robert Lepage, who I did not know at the time. It was 1992. And I had my score of HMS Pinafore. I was, you know, was lightly doing some theater, operetta.
Sure.
And he came in and blew me away with the simplicity of what he was saying, which was, stay in architecture. It's an incredible field in which to learn all of these different things. You don't have to be an architect. You could be a filmmaker. You could be a set designer. You could be anything, but architecture is the mother of all the arts.
Wow.
He was speaking at it from someone who was a theater guy and a comedy improv guy, but who had a real interest in interdisciplinary art.
Yeah.
And I knew right away I wanted to do things like he did. I wanted to have the creative freedom and control that he has, but also the sense of this naive quality that you have when you walk into a room and say, let's do...
Anything is possible.
Anything is possible. Let's bring an acrobat from Spain who doesn't speak English, and let's make a show with her.
I love it. Yeah, absolutely.
What the hell?
Let's make a show. That's the classic.
You don't know how to play trumpet? You have 6 months.
Learn how to play trumpet.
Yeah. We need a brass section.
But having the confidence in people who were involved in that process to go, I think you can do it. You know, that's part of the magic. So then you sign up for a theater class?
Then I started looking at his work and realizing, okay, you know, it's not Gilbert and Sullivan, but maybe there's more to be found in it. So I started taking acting classes at McGill. And I realized that a lot of the teachers there were really quite good. It wasn't a big theater program like the National Theater School. And yet some of the same teachers were teaching at McGill. So I then started to take as many classes as I could, but coming at it from the outside.
Right.
I was one of the only people not in the English theater department. And I really enjoyed that outsider feeling of being able to bring a whole other set of skills and knowledge to it, and also being able to not be jaded about it.
And was there a moment when you realized as an outsider that the group you were coming into, what did you have to do to prove yourself? There must have been some point when they said, oh yeah, okay, he's not just dabbling.
It's a good question because it was difficult. I graduated and I stayed with my graduate degree in architecture, and then the first thing I did right after was I played Shakespeare in the Park in Montreal, Repercussion Theater, playing Murderer Number 2 in a production of Mac. Excuse me, working for free, which, you know, with a graduate degree, your mother is looking at you going, are you insane? And yet, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew because I didn't have the National Theater School degree, I was not going to get a big role.
Sure.
I had to prove myself. Yeah. And, you know, I had to take a little humble pie for half a year. Yeah. But at the end of that summer, I developed McHomer.
Oh,
and
that quickly.
Over the course of the next winter, I was not only cast as the lead in the following year for the Shakespeare in the Park, where I met my wife playing, just coming out of school. We were playing Shakespearean Lovers and As You Like It and Comedy of Errors. So I had graduated already to better roles, but I had also created my own first show, which was a huge hit from the get-go.
At the Fringe Festival.
Yes, and it, you know, a good concept, but well executed, more importantly. And it was immediately a hit, and that's when my mother got off my back and said, okay,
that's hilarious.
All right, so maybe he can make a living at this.
It took that.
And so, you get your lumps over the years. You know, it was hard.
It's hard.
It's always hard. Yeah. And there are moments where you're rattling your cup going, somebody, give me some money.
Rattling your cup, yeah. But it's fascinating. I can't really speculate, but I was going to say, if you wouldn't have created McHomer, if you wouldn't have developed something for you, which is a great lesson, that's the lesson in this, for all the people that are out there that are struggling, thinking, okay, why doesn't anyone recognize my talent? Maybe the question is, you have to recognize it yourself and then figure out what to do with it. I mean, you created a show that was perfect for you.
Yes, I created a show, I think, out of someone who's not necessarily the best actor, the best visual artist, the best musician, but I could dabble in all these
you're
things.
Comfortable. You've got a comfort level in all those.
Exactly.
Those
and learning from the people who do it better, but being able to be, again, this hack of all trades is extremely beneficial in the creative process if you want to make stuff.
Yeah.
If you don't want to make anything and you want to be hired and that's fine. But I think even if you are going to be that kind of creator, you can really benefit from the process of making your own things. And when I go to theater schools and I talk to students, I think what I try to leave them is a sense that, this Martha Graham quote, Martha Graham being the extraordinary dancer, the quote, if I may paraphrase it, if I can't say it exactly, is, there is no satisfaction whatever at any time. There is only a queer divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive than the others. And I find that so eloquent. You can Google "keep the channel open," Martha Graham.
At the darkest moments, I'm sure.
Yes, because it says you have something to give the world.
Within
and even though everything's been written, you may feel you have nothing to give. If you open yourself to it and say, the world does not have the way I have said it, and open yourself to the fact that you have something to say and something to make that is unique to you, you should go through that process and realize that maybe it's not your thing, but the world is better off with you being a creative person than you being not creative.
Hmm.
And I feel that way about anyone.
How did you find that quote? Where'd that come from?
I was given it. I have it on my wall. My mother threw a lot of quotes at us, not this one, but I loved inspiration. You know, I'm a generalist, right? I love Joseph Campbell. I love these quotes that are somewhat ethereal,
right?
And yet you can apply to very localized
concrete places in your psyche.
And when you're on your own in a career like this, you need sometimes to be reminded that the failure quote that or the idea that I gave, which is take away the stigma around failure. Yeah, Fail a little bit less every day and don't be afraid
Move
of it.
Ahead.
But also keep the channel open and always be creative and never feel that you've achieved. Never feel that you're there.
Right.
Because that means everything is a product. Hmm. And if you look at life, even the life we design these days, and with the tools we have now, it's a lot easier to fashion a career a bit like a creation. It's ongoing. It never ends. And it's organic.
Yeah.
It's cyclical. Yeah. It's not a straight line of progress
where you achieve a
destination. Yeah. The people who achieve destinations, who have preconceived destinations, product-oriented people will inevitably be disappointed.
That's fascinating.
By the fact that life does not work that way.
Right. Yeah. It's always. Wow, it's kind of profound. I don't know what to say. No, I'm just kidding. But here's something. So we're talking about using our own creative self to do something and work with what's around you. So I'll ask you a question. We'll probably end up on this too. Ask you a question about Boom, the project that's you're working on now and have been working on for a while. And my understanding, it was commissioned by the Stratford Festival?
Stratford under Des McAnuff.
Sure.
Des and I had been talking for a few years about working on something together. At that stage, I had not been to Stratford before because that is a whole different world
of
committing to another city for nine, being part of a company, doing the show.
You're out of the loop. You booked out for a period of time.
And you have some of the finest actors and creators in the country working there, and the staff and the support staff. But it's something that was for other people, in my point of view. Des and I had been talking about a show. He came to Australia. He was in Australia working on something. He came to see Bigger Than Jesus, loved what I was doing, and said, "We should have you at Stratford."
Good for him.
And I said, "Well, how could I fit what I want to do at Stratford and be a part of your company?" And he said, "Well, yes, we'll need you to be part of our shows. And I'm happy to do that. I love being part of a company. Yeah. I just also want to make something of my own."
Of course.
And so we found a way to commission this play, and Stratford gave me some initial seed money to start writing it. Without any guarantee, we're looking 2 years in advance for it to be part of the season. Now, as you know, Des left, Anthony came on, big changes. The Stratford Festival was on,
had a big shift,
and in a lot of ways, some companies need to be shaken sometimes, and Anthony reined a lot of what Des was doing.
Absolutely.
A lot of the, let's bring a Mick Homer and a Chris Plummer, and let's bring all these solo artists and create a more eclectic festival. Anthony reined it in and sort of put a tighter focus on theme and on company, no longer these people from the outside coming in. And so Boom, even though Anthony and I talked about it for a long time, and they continued to support it, ended up not fitting as part of their plans, but it was mutual.
Right.
I felt at this stage that perhaps Boom would be better off, with great thanks to Stratford for helping develop it, having it as one of my own shows.
So I'm going to get just technical with you. In terms of, because it was Lorne Elliott, my buddy from Montreal, who said, business people get together and talk about art, artists get together and talk about money, because it's always about, clinking the cup, as you were saying, rattling the cup. So how does that work? When they grant you or do a commission, they give you some seed money. Do they then own a piece of that? Do you have to buy it back from them?
You have a pretty long contract that you have to pore over. And Stratford has, in the past, I think, they've had certain productions where they had not been smart about continuing to gain royalties and such. And so I think they drafted a contract that was extremely detailed about protecting their own interests in their investment.
Yeah, because they're putting money and time and resources.
And again, much appreciated. So I did sign that contract, but part of the contract was, at a certain stage, if we choose not to go ahead, the property reverts entirely to you. And so
Stratford has to make that call.
Yes, they make the call. And they made a call at a certain point. It wasn't fitting into the themes the way they're working. Not commissioning the kind of solo work from the outside that they're doing. They want their company to be part of the studio season well. So it's just a different way of going.
So they eventually made that call. And so you're okay with it.
Yeah, we made that call together. And then it reverted back to me. And immediately I got on the phone.
Yeah, let's go.
And within a week, I had met Dennis Garnham of Theatre Calgary, who was looking for a show to fill his January 2014 slot at the High Performance Rodeo Festival out in Stratford. Theatre Calgary always presents a show, not produces, presents.
Oh, okay.
So I then had a year to go from, we've been doing workshops,
How do I get it up?
So to speak.
Well, I wasn't even going there, but go ahead.
And we got Boom up through the extra money that was now coming in through Theatre Calgary, a lot of your own funding, which happens, you know.
And time, blood money.
And a lot of time and partners pulling it together. And I still have now a year before the show will, in my mind, officially premiere in January of 2015 at Mirvish.
Okay.
And that'll be announced in the next couple of weeks. So by time this airs, it's safe to say.
Yeah.
But then it'll be on tour for a while, and I will eventually train someone else to do what Lepage does, which is have someone take over the show and then tour it and make sure that they're really good.
Right.
But then move on to other projects and not be away from my family.
Technically, who's the director?
I'm the director, writer, performer, which a lot of people would think stupid choice.
Sure, but you've got a crew. I was watching the video online, and you've got people working with you, as you said earlier.
I have a lot of people. And an interesting thing about this particular cafe, I talked about working on that play here, was that we film every workshop process quite extensively so that by the end when we perform what we've got, I then have a performance on video on three separate cameras that I edit and put together, and I essentially direct myself.
Well, okay,
I add images, I add sound, I cheat, I move things around. So in a way, I'm the playwright and the director, not only when I'm in the play, but mostly afterwards.
You step outside and actually physically watch it on tape. And
I literally direct myself. I have myself say different things,
and
I move different images on top because I'm using a lot of multimedia. And it's a fascinating process
that
would not be possible without technology.
So multimedia, and then but then again, you're actually in this little cafe recreating it, deconstructing it, making notes to yourself.
And that's partly stepping out of the home situation, even down the block.
Of course.
Because, like it or not,
I can't do it. I used to have to work in the house. It killed me, basically, because I couldn't do anything till 10 o'clock. My wife was asleep. My little guy was asleep. The house was quiet. And then I'd work till 2 in the morning, and I was a basket case. Look, it was crazy. You can't do anything. So you have to get, luckily, I have an office at work. Now I'm going to my office more. I'm like, okay, I'll go during regular
hours. University?
Yeah.
I have an office there, too. I'm going there today. It's great.
No, it helps to get away. Now, this has been great. I don't want to go too far into Boom because it's coming up, and hopefully people will go out and see it.
It will. It's had its birth, and like in any kind of creation, there's that fear of will people like my baby? And even from what I call our preview run in Calgary, it was such an incredible response.
Absolutely.
And even more importantly than the reviews, I make the lobby part of the play, in that the post show, I come out and we don't have the video set up we want with people recording their stories and feeding into a digital timeline, because we have a big part of the show that'll be online and digital.
Okay.
But the post show experience where I talk back to people and ask their questions is literally asking for their feedback.
Yeah.
Saying, how can you be part of this process?
Yeah.
What works for you? What doesn't? Because it's always changing. It's always evolving. And I like talking to people.
Of course, yeah.
To some actors, I think it's a terrible thing to not only read your own reviews, but actually talk to the audience. I happen to feed on it. Part ego, part humility again.
Well, there was the first people I saw do that, I was off Broadway. This would have been probably in the late 80s, was Penn & Teller. They were doing their off-Broadway show, and after the show, they were in the lobby, dressed in their outfits, and they were literally just shooting and talking to people. And then I saw them a little while ago on the road. If you address Penn, he'll say, never been better, boss. That's his thing, because he's addressing the public as his boss.
And we have my partners and I, who are developing all these new shows. Boom is the first in a kind of new way of looking at shows. And so they're in Montreal, Craig Francis, Jeff Lord, working with this company called Cadoons, who have an online network already of digital properties where we're aiming to entertain, but also educate, enlighten, empower, usually young people. So every show we create starts with a play, but has an online webisode, educational module.
Different components. Just to bring
components.
It to life. So
you
can extend the show and extend the experience for those that want to get more out of it.
Often you get shows that, you spend a few months creating it, it lives and dies.
And it's gone,
A website that lives and dies.
Sure,
and so we're trying to be a lot smarter about creating something that's sustainable, that in the case of Boom talks about history. So obviously history,
that
Canadian
period,
history, students want a way of learning history that is less boring.
That's great. So
I can parcel
politics.
Boom and create these little bits of almost like a Wikipedia sort of version of Boom, where you have the play, you have the little bits of the play, but each bit, if I'm talking about Che Guevara for 30 seconds on stage, can become its own study module. And so we're creating this network of properties.
Because you've gone through all that work anyway. You've actually done it. You didn't just pick something out of Wikipedia to throw on the show. You have a deep understanding of what's going on.
And I've had to curate it so that, yes, I can't tell every story.
Right.
And yet what I wanted to do, which was what I was getting on with the audience in Calgary, was that it was so nice. People after the show would come and they'd tell me their stories.
Right.
And that's when you've achieved something.
Yeah.
When not only have they connected with your story or the stories you've invented, or in this case, documented, because it's kind of my father's story, sort of my mother's story, a little bit. They connected with that, but then they're thinking, you know what? My dad was in World War II as well. And I remember the time when or this young guy, this 18-year-old said, I didn't live through Perry Como nor Janis Joplin, you know, from that range to there, but I was imagining that that's what my grandmother was going through.
So
and she's not alive anymore.
Gives them meaning and depth.
Yeah. So I wanted this thing that could relate to people now.
Yeah.
And I think in the case of Boom, how we remember things and the way we remember them, how we document it, how we tell those stories tells us not only about them then, but about now and about how we're going. We tend to look at things in a product straight line.
Yeah.
Things are cyclical. You might have realized that you become your parents in ways
absolutely.
That are perhaps ways you wouldn't have thought of
at age
18.
What have I held on from that era and what have I let go? And music is such a big thing for everyone.
Sure.
Wow. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it.
I want my work to reflect, you know, who I am and the complexity of that and also the sometimes the naivete of that.
Right.
And in the case of 20,000 Leagues, I love playing with action figures. I love miniatures. I love working with toys.
Yeah.
That play reflects an environmental concern because it's about water. Boom is about history.
Right.
McHomer was about Shakespeare, but it was also about silliness. And, and I love the silliness of McHomer. It's a goofy play. Whereas Bigger Than Jesus was not goofy at all. So all of these things, I think, are parts of me that
the
I want.
Multifaceted Rick
Miller. And I think creative people should not necessarily want to create an international hit.
Every time.
They should create locally. Yeah. Going back to the Martha Graham quote, express what is truthful to you and then let it be universal. Don't create universal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Think local.
What a great way to end. Thanks, Rick. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Cheers, Keith.
In the hood here. Well, there you go. That's Rick Miller at his little pastry shop, La Pâtisserie, just around the corner from his house. Don't you love that image he created? Sitting there with the world going on around him. You know, a little almond croissant there, cappuccino, cafe au lait over there. And there he is in the midst of it all, editing some of the most exciting creative work to come out of Canada, all done on his laptop at the Pâtisserie in Toronto. Very cool. If you haven't already checked out one of his shows, check out Boom. It's playing right now in Toronto at the Panasonic Theater. Then it moves over to British Columbia. And then he's got a show in Kelowna and then a show in Vernon. Those are both one-nighters in March. Check that out. If you've got friends in Kelowna or Vernon, tell them to go see the show. And then he comes to London, Ontario, my hood. That's where I'm recording this right now in my suburban basement spare room. It's so messy. You know, I'd be a creative genius like Rick, but I really have to clean up my room first. I'm kind of busy. And I'll never clean this thing up. Hey, I hope you were inspired. If you weren't inspired, check out some of the back episodes. I'm sure there'll be someone there who rings a bell and gets you going. Just visit theinadequatelife.com and check out the episode guide. Also, we're on iTunes, or if you have a new iPhone, just go to the podcast app and search theinadequatelife.com. That's it for now. See you next time on The Inadequate Life. I'm Keith Tomasek. Thanks for listening.